So I mentioned a second ago, everybody, please turn to Deuteronomy chapter 12. We'll begin this evening in chapter 12. And while you're turning, I might just say that little burst of joy that we had a few moments ago, you know, before we got started, just reminds me of how wonderful it truly is to be a part of this congregation. There's such joy here, and just peace and camaraderie and, you know, fellowship, and I just appreciate it so very much. Thank you all for that. I have felt for some weeks that I've been abusing you pretty badly on Sunday mornings, this marriage, divorce, remarriage thing. You know, it's a heavy topic, and, you know, I come into that class like I'm juggling 18 different bowling pins, you know, thinking about the range of knowledge that we have here and who's listening on the tape and all the rest of that, you know. So I know it's been a kind of an odd class and all, but just to come in tonight, it truly, you know, just lights me up. It's a joy to be a part of this congregation. It's just a joy to be here with each and every one of you. Good, fine Bible students, enjoy each other's company. What's better than that? It's like the oil on Aaron's beard now, isn't it? Psalm 133. Okay, well, that's it. Here's a typical title slide. This will be our seventh class in Deuteronomy. And what I did here, I found this phenomenal map online. I've seen it before. It is extremely high quality. And so you're able then to crop it. It shows the entirety of Israel, as a matter of fact, in the original. Then I cropped it down to just a few miles down here in the south. But I wanted to show you, you know, a satellite photo here. This is Mount Nebo, the ridgeline that you see right in here. I imagine that might be the actual peak, I guess, right there. Oh, no, let's see. Is that right? No, it's this one. Well, I wonder why that moved. I thought I had that arrow pointing over here. Okay, well, anyway, it's this mountain right here. And I wanted you to see that here in the north end of the Dead Sea, 8 miles across, you know, we have the plains of Moab. This is all that area right there. But you'll notice, you know, as the Jordan comes down through here, Jericho right across, you know, at the foot of the hills that rise up toward Jerusalem, you know, here they are coming out of the wilderness wanderings. They've conquered everything on the east. They've come down to this mountain, but they're at the foot of the mountain, and Moses is climbing back and forth, you know, here as well. And he's going to have one last trip, of course. It's coming pretty soon. But see how there's this big area right here, and again, kind of a big area right here, where people could gather. And you've got the real low, gentle foothills, you know, of course, at the bottom all along there. There would just be numerous places where you could set up your natural amphitheater. And Moses could come. It's pretty apparent he didn't reveal all of Deuteronomy 24 in one session. So they would be meeting several days, you know, in a row, several hours in a day, no in a doubt. And they're spending a tremendous amount of time together in assembly. Day after day, apparently, as he reveals, chapter after chapter, this will be written, and then he will climb that mountain that one last time. Again, he's going to have the view of the entirety, you know, of Israel, but he'll die upon that mountain. He's never going to get into that promised land. And so, as I mentioned, I think 2 or 3 weeks back, you know, we have just this most passionate, this wonderfully emotional, you know, father for his children, leader for, you know, his fellow workers and sufferers out there in the wilderness. And so it's just such a moment in biblical history, this whole book. And I hope you're kind of catching that flavor. It always gets to my heart. It gets me emotionally when I remember those things and I read this and I try to put myself, you know, into Moses' shoes. He's facing an audience. It's vastly larger than what I do, but it's what I do. Hoping out of pure love to help people learn what they need to know to have successful, happy lives and to be blessed with all of the things that God has to offer in this physical world, and then, of course, heaven itself as well. So if you've been one, and I think a lot of people are, who just kind of avoids Deuteronomy and think, well, it's, you know, it's just another Leviticus, and it's not, you know, a whole lot of fun in a way. And I appreciate all of that, and yet at the same time, it is Moses' last chance, knowing that he is soon to die, to reach the hearts of these people, to motivate them, to, you know, to hopefully affect a vow of faithfulness to their God that's going to endure, he hopes, for generations to come, and yet also knowing that they won't. And we'll be getting into that material before very long. Chapter 17 is going to really hit on it pretty heavily. They will fail. He knows they're going to fail because God's telling him he's going to fail. And so imagine how your heart is just torn and churning. You know, you're pleading, do right. And if they do, they'll be okay. But he knows also at various times in the long cycle of Jewish history, the people will choose not to. And they're going to suffer horribly. And there'll be much bloodshed. And, you know, he's a man filled with 120 years of life. And he's had, you know, the heights of Egyptian splendor. He's had the lowliness of Midian, you know, shepherd. And then he's had the suffering and carrying, you know, that he repeatedly talks about, so difficult, carrying these people and all their whining, complaining, griping about everything that he did, always trying to straighten Moses out, you know, teach him how to teach. And now he comes and it's over. This is the end of it. I'm at the end. Here, what can I say and do? Well, God's given me the words, but it's Moses' heart that God's working with. So, here we are in this natural giant amphitheater. From the heights we can see to this day, Don and I have done it, you can see some of the buildings on the ridgeline that are in Jerusalem itself. And you can look up and down for 100 miles, you know, of the promised land. And Moses now facing these people. So tonight, we're going to pick up the pace, as I told you I would last week. Particularly now that we're in chapter 12, we begin the Deuteronomos, the second law. So we can go faster because we've read this material in Leviticus. We studied it in some detail when we were back in Leviticus. So we've recently covered this in the last few months. And I'm not going to just read it, you know, again. Now we can do a lot of reading tonight, though. This is the only slide I have for you this evening. So there it is. Moses is teaching the people, and I think hopefully we can get through these four chapters then in this manner. All of chapter 12, though, I would like to read, and get your pencils out, because in a minute I want to give you a list that I think is valuable. But let's mostly just be reading through this 12th chapter now without too much comments. Pretty obvious. These are the statutes and the judgments which you shall carefully observe in the land which Yahweh, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess as long as you live on the earth. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. You shall tear down their altars and smash their pillars and burn their Asherim with fire, and you shall cut down the engraved images of their gods. You shall obliterate their name from that place. You shall not act like this toward Yahweh your God. Now, how many times have we heard God tell these people in the last 40 years, when you cross that Jordan River and enter this land, you're going to get fields that you did not, you know, clear. You're going to get houses you didn't build. You're going to inherit the cisterns and everything else. But you're going to find these people there, and these people are not faithful to me. So, I want you to be real nice and be very friendly and eminently, you know, polite and never do anything to offend them. Yes or no?
No.
Well, no. I want you to destroy them. Now, in our case as Christians, brethren, it's still our job to destroy their doctrine, to rid the earth of these lies, which will keep you out of heaven. We're not supposed to make friends with it. It's not a matter of, you know, Mr. Nice Guy and we can woo them in. It doesn't work that way. So God has always taught his people to declare war against that which is false. And the image in the symbolic presentation of the physicality of the Old Testament is the actual physical bloodshed. I want you to kill them. Man, woman, child, and beast. I want you to kill them because their doctrine is that dangerous. Verse 4, you shall not act like this toward Yahweh your God. You've got to get rid of these people or you'll be influenced by these people and they'll win. They'll be so nice. They'll be so attractive. they'll be so devoted to their gods, and there'll be so much for you to learn unless you maintain your distinct, separate status, beginning with their annihilation, is the image in the Old Testament and the actuality. Now, verse 5. What you shall do, you shall seek Yahweh at the place which Yahweh your God shall choose from all your tribes to establish his name there for his dwelling, and there you shall come. There you shall bring your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the contributions of your hand, your votive offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herd and of your flock. There also you and your household shall eat before Yahweh your God and rejoice in all your undertakings in which Yahweh your God has blessed you. You shall not do at all what we are doing here today. Every man, whatever's right in his own eyes. Now, that's a shocking verse to me. And for the second time in a week, I have to say I don't know that I can understand it. I think it's one of those you had to be there to get it. You know, how is it that these people, led by Moses these 40 years, having conquered, you know, the nations that are on the eastern side of the Dead Sea and all along in Jordan up all the way into Syria before they're going to come across into Jericho, and before, you know, this moment that he's speaking like this, how are they just doing whatever's right in their own eyes? We have another passage in you know, later in their biblical history when they're doing that, and it's not good. It's not good here, and it's not good there. So he says, we're not going to do what we're doing here once we get over there, and what we will not be doing is whatever's right in your own eyes. So I'm not sure what degree or level of faithfulness and commitment these people have. I don't understand the insight that Moses has or the divine revelation that God's giving him by inspiration, you know, to say to those people, even here where you can walk over there and drink out of the Jordan River, you're just doing whatever's right in your own eyes instead of serving your God. So Moses has spent, you know, the last 40 years trying to encourage people not to do it the way they do it in the world and learn to be a separate and superior and very recognizable, distinct people from everything else. Our task to this day. Verse 9, you have not yet as come, you have not as yet come to the resting place, to the inheritance which Yahweh your God is giving you. When you cross the Jordan and live in the land which Yahweh your God is giving you to inherit, he gives you rest from all your enemies around you so that you live in security. Then it shall come about that the place in which Yahweh your God shall choose for his name to dwell, there you shall bring all that I command you. Your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the contribution of your hand, all your choice votive offerings, which you will vow to Yahweh. You shall rejoice before Yahweh your God, you and your sons and your daughters, your male and female servants, the Levite who's within your gates, since he has no portion or inheritance with you. Be careful that you do not offer your burnt offerings in every place you see, but in the place which Yahweh chooses in one of your tribes, there you shall offer your burnt offerings, and there you shall do all that I command you. Now, there's going to be an addition to this, but you will now have observed that starting with verse 9 down through 14, that segment is all about, I'm going to pick Jerusalem. I'm going to say, there and nowhere else. The people you're among, they're doing it everywhere. Every high hill and green tree, they have, you know, their cultic practices. You are going to be rooted. You will offer your sacrifices. You will eat of those sacrifices, which once offered, I authorize you to eat of there in this place. 15. However, you may slaughter and eat meat within any of your gates, whatever you desire, according to the blessing of Yahweh your God, which he's given you. The unclean and the clean may eat of it, as of the gazelle and the deer. Now, that's kind of odd to us in verse 15, because clean and unclean has been designated, and the Jews cannot eat anything that's unclean. They are to destroy, that is, to put to death every man, woman, and child and their livestock of seven stipulated nations that are in this land. Seven stipulated peoples are to be exterminated. But does that mean that they will never have people living among them who are not Jews? Does not mean that. In the first place, starting right off with the Gibeonites, they're going to make that mistake and not put them to death, enter into a covenant they should not have, and then be told, even though you made a covenant you shouldn't, you've got to keep the covenant. That's food for thought on a couple of different levels. Even if you make a covenant you weren't supposed to make, God teaches them you got to keep the covenant, because breaking another covenant is not the solution. So they're going to have those people living among them, and they were a thorn in their side, though they were hewers of wood and water carriers. You know, and they're going to have others that are outside the seven nations that they are to exterminate. So they can eat both the clean and the what? The unclean. Those foreigners can eat the unclean, and they will, and we'll see it tonight where he says so. This is where it starts. Bill?
That verse says the people that are clean or unclean can eat of these things, not what they're eating.
You may slaughter and eat meat within any of your gates, whatever you desire, according to the blessing of Yahweh your God, which he's given you. The unclean and the clean may eat of it, as of the gazelle and the deer. Okay? And so I think it goes both ways. You've got people that are clean and unclean, if you will, but you've also got animals that are clean and unclean. And I have thrown you off because I'm reading only this verse. We'll get to another one where it's clearer. But the people that live among them can eat both. Okay? So, but, you know, you can slaughter all. All right, so now we come to 16. Only you shall not eat the blood. You are to pour it out on the ground like water. Now skip to verse 23. Only be sure not to eat the blood, for the blood is the life, and you shall not eat the life with the flesh. Now, despite the fact that we've already talked about this in both Leviticus 7 and in Leviticus 17, I want to give you the list. So I think the best way to go about this is at verse 16, if you've got room in the margin, write C, S-E-E, list at Genesis 9:4. C, list at Genesis 9:4. Now, if you write that here, then move back to Genesis 9:4, and everybody have a look-see. Maybe you've already done it because I directed you to do this when we were in Leviticus. But for those of you who weren't here at that time, please come back to chapter 9 and verse 4. There may be some among you that will be hearing this more than once, but this, you know, for those of you that don't, weren't here. In Genesis 9:4, write not eat blood, if you will. And then here's the list, because it's a good deal bigger, not a good deal, but it's bigger, than just what we've already studied. So here's the list. The first time God forbids the eating and drinking of blood and requires that you pour it out instead of eat it is here in Genesis 9:4. There, now, you want to write this list. Leviticus 7:26. And in Leviticus chapter 17, verse 10. And still in Leviticus, chapter 19, verse 26. And then in Deuteronomy, chapter 12, as we just saw, verses 16 and 23. And then in Acts 15, for Christians, in Acts 15, it's at verse 28. This is a universal prohibition for all human beings. Before Moses, during Moses, and after Moses. There's a lot of things that are always consistent. And it's only the ceremonial stuff of the Old Testament that's done away in Christianity. The moral laws don't evaporate. You don't suddenly get to eat and drink blood. These are the kinds of things that are permanent and have always been. They're not related to Moses. They don't come and go. So there's your whole list. Again, it's Leviticus 7:26, 17:10, and 19:26. Then it's Deuteronomy 12:16 and 23, And then Acts 15:28. If you put that list at Genesis 9:4, you'll have them all. God's pretty intent on keeping this in place. So, enough said on that. We talked about that before. So let's come on back now to chapter 12 and verse 17. You're not allowed to eat within your gates the tithe of your grain or new wine or oil or the firstborn of your herd or flock or any of your votive offerings which you vow or your freewill offering or the contribution of your hand. But you shall eat them before Yahweh your God in the place which Yahweh your God will choose. We're back to Jerusalem again. You and your son and daughter, your male, female servants, Levite is within your gates. You shall rejoice before Yahweh your God in all your undertakings. He just said that. Back here, starting in verses 9 and following, he's saying it again, seconds later. It's important enough to be repeated. Be careful you do not forsake the Levite as long as you live in your land. When Yahweh your God extends your border as he has promised you, and you say, I'll eat meat, because you desire to eat meat, then you may eat meat, whatever you desire. If the place which Yahweh your God chooses to put his name is too far from you, then you may slaughter of your herd and flock which Yahweh has given you as I've commanded you, and you may eat within your gates whatever you desire. Just as gazelle or deer is eaten, so you shall eat it. The unclean and the clean alike may eat of it. Only be sure not to eat the blood, for the blood is the life, and you shall not eat the life with the flesh. You shall not eat it. You shall pour it out on the ground like water. You shall not eat it. Three times in adjoining verses. In order that it may be well with you and your sons after you, for you will be doing what is right in the sight of Yahweh. Only your holy things which you may have in your votive offerings you shall take and go to the place which Yahweh chooses. And you shall offer your burnt offerings, the flesh and the blood, on the altar of Yahweh your God, and the blood of your sacrifices shall be poured out on the altar of Yahweh your God, and you shall eat the flesh. Be careful to listen to all these words which I command you, in order that it may be well with you and your sons after you forever. For you will be doing what is good and right in the sight of Yahweh your God. Now, in case they missed the point. 29. When Yahweh your God cuts off before you the nations which you're going in to dispossess, and you dispossess them and dwell in their land, beware that you're not ensnared to follow them. After they are destroyed before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how do these nations serve their gods, that I also may do likewise? You shall not behave thus toward Yahweh your God. That's how the chapter started. For every abominable act which Yahweh hates, they have done for their gods. They even burn their sons and daughters in the fire of their gods. Whatever I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall not add to nor take away from it. You remember, brother, we've always been, and very rightly so, masters of lists of verses in the New Testament about how you cannot add or take away from God's Word. Is that new in Christianity? Well, no. It's always been that way. You get it from His hand, and you don't get to change it. You don't add it, you don't take away, and God isn't likely to change His mind either. This is it. Keep it. It'll be well for you, your sons, and forever. Okay, now, I'm going to leave that, you know, because it's fairly similar to what we've seen before, and focus more now on chapter 13. First, grab your pencil, and there, chapter 13 and verse 1, please write Jeremiah 14, verses 13 through 16. Jeremiah 14, 13 through 16. Now, I'll read that for you so you won't have to turn over there, and then we'll get into this, and you'll see it's, you know, it's so similar. But in Jeremiah 14, 13, it says, but, ah, Lord God, I said, look, the prophets are telling them you'll not see the sword, nor will you have famine, but I'll give you lasting peace in this place. Then Yahweh said to Jeremiah, the prophets are prophesying falsehood in my name. I've neither sent them nor commanded them nor spoken to them. They're prophesying to you a false vision, divination, futility, and the deception of their own minds. Therefore, thus says Yahweh concerning the prophets who are prophesying in my name, although it was not I who sent them. Yet they keep saying, there shall be no sword or famine in this land. By sword and famine, these prophets shall meet their end. The people also to whom they're prophesying will be thrown out into the streets of Jerusalem because of the famine and the sword, and there'll be no one to bury them. Them, their wives, nor their sons, nor their daughters, for I shall pour out their wickedness upon them. Well, this is Matthew 15, 12 through 14, which I cited last Sunday morning. These people will not worship their God. These people will provide substitutes. I was having a 90-minute Bible study I do with a couple of preacher friends of mine on Monday nights, every Monday night. And the doorbell rang right in the middle of it. So Donna goes to the door. Now, those of you that have been in the house, you know there, we've got one of those kind of quasi-stained glass things, you know. So I could see Donna standing at the door. I could see her back. And then through the window of the door, I could see a figure out there, but I can't make out what it is at all. And then as I'm walking past on the phone, you know, having this Bible study, you know, Donna looks at me kind of plaintively, you know, like, can you come to the door? So I said, okay. And so I hung up on the Bible study. I went to the door, and what do I find? I find an 18-year-old boy, just as handsome and fresh a face as you ever saw. Okay. Trying to sell me Seventh-day Adventist literature for some event he's got going on at the high school. Now, what am I supposed to do? What's the big temptation? Well, you know, he's young and innocent and all the rest of that. So what I did is I threw both my hands around his throat and I started to twist. I said, I'm just so torn here. You know, I'm of two minds. I really appreciate a young, ambitious guy like yourself out here hardworking and all the rest of that. But it went on to tell him, you, however, have been deceived by a false prophet. If you're interested in studying the Bible, here's my card. I looked for some DVDs, but I didn't have a copy of the debate, you know, in stock, and so I couldn't give him one. You know, and I just appealed to him. Let's study. We really need to talk, you know. And, of course, was he the least bit interested? No. No. Saved us both a lot of time, didn't he? I gave him an opportunity. That's your job as a Christian before God. What's their responsibility? Have an open heart. Okay? I quoted Proverbs 18:17 to him. I said, look, first to plead his case seems just until another comes and examines him. You grew up in a household that was Adventist. My children grew up in and among those of the Church of Christ. Both of those traditions need to be tested. You can't just accept it because that's what you grew up in, and it all sounds good because that's all you've ever heard. Why don't you study with me? Bye-bye. He was gone. Now, brethren, what are these people going to do when they come into this land? They're going to put to death everybody that's on the list of these seven. And these false prophets, God, century after century, when the blind lead the blind, who falls in the ditch? Both of them. That's also in Matthew 15. When the blind lead the blind, brethren, they both fall in the ditch. Whose job is it to get a hold of the blind so we prevent the ditch falling? It's us or nobody. Okay? So you can't just say, well, here, let me walk with you for 10 or 12 years. You got to do something about it, you know. And that's what God is saying here. These false prophets are all saying, you know, this punishment's not going to come. Well, I'm telling you it is, and they'll die the very way they say that they won't. So now let's read about it. What is the test that I've consistently applied for Ellen White and all the rest of the false teachers that are out there today, who we have are duty-bound to oppose and defeat every bit as much as the Jews were? If a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes true, concerning which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods whom you've not known, and let us serve them, you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for Yahweh your God is testing you to find out if you love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul. A reminder of Jesus saying, no one comes to the Father except by me. You must love me more than your father, your mother, your spouse, your children. Though always God's been fairly demanding, hasn't he? So, here's the test. When you have to associate with those who have spent their lives refusing to serve God, whether they're in your family, whether they're your next door neighbor, whether they're, you know, people you work with, go to school with, or whatever. They've had years and years and years and years in this free land that is carpeted and wallpapered with Bibles to come to God, and they won't do it. What do you do? Well, brethren, they're being tested, and they're failing. And you're being tested. And if you don't say anything to them, you're failing. You, verse 4, shall follow Yahweh your God and fear Him. You shall keep His commandments and listen to His voice and serve Him and cling to Him. But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death because he's counseled rebellion against Yahweh your God, who brought you from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery to seduce you from the way in which Yahweh your God commanded you to walk. So you shall purge the evil from among you. Now, I stop there for just a minute. Did this person apparently work a miracle? It says so. They gave you a sign or a wonder, and it came to pass. There will be false signs and wonders. There will be what appears to be miracles. We've got a whole thing called Pentecostalism today. The entire charismatic movement is based on this lie. So they think they've seen miracles. They believe they've seen signs. So how do you know to put the guy to death? Because Moses was working signs, and the prophets would work signs. How do you tell them apart? We just read it. You should know. Yeah, you got to have a Bible study. Because even when they're working miracles, they have to agree with God's revealed revelation. So they start to counsel you to do anything you can't read about in your Bible, even if they're working miracles. What do? Well, if you're a Jew, you put them to death. Now, we're not a theocracy today. Christianity's different. Romans 13 applies. I understand all of that. But as far as God is concerned, there's no love for Ellen White, the Pope, or anybody else that's taught millions of people not to serve God. That's a problem. It still is. In fact, it's such a problem, God's trying to train us and them via this passage in verse 6. If your brother, your mother's son, or your son or daughter, or the wife you cherish, or your friend who is as your own soul, entice you secretly saying, let us go and serve other gods whom neither you nor your fathers have known, of the gods of the peoples who are around you, near you or far from you, from one end of the earth to the other end. You shall not yield to him or listen to him, and your eye shall not pity him, nor shall you spare or conceal him. But you shall surely kill him. Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. So you shall stone him to death because he has sought to seduce you from Yahweh your God, who brought you out from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Then all Israel will hear and be afraid and will never again do such a wicked thing among you. It's tough being a Jew. Aren't you glad that God doesn't care if we're evangelistic or not anymore, and we don't have to stand against false doctrine? Aren't you glad that with Christianity all that went away? Well, it didn't, did it? That putting to death did, because this is not a theocracy. That was, so they could, and should have. I don't know how often they did, but they failed if they didn't. The brethren, it gets worse. If you want to call it worse, it gets better if it's coming out of the mouth of God in verse 12. If you hear in one of your cities, which Yahweh your God is giving you to live in, anyone saying that some worthless man have gone out from among you and have seduced the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods whom you have not known, then you shall investigate, search out, inquire thoroughly, and if it's true that the matter is established that this abomination has been done among you, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it and all that's in it and its cattle with the edge of the sword. Then you shall gather all its booty into the middle of its open square and burn the city and all its booty with fire as a whole burnt offering to Yahweh your God. And it shall be a ruin forever. It shall never be rebuilt. And nothing from that which is put under the ban shall cling to your hand, in order that Yahweh may turn from his burning anger and show mercy to whom? To you. And you weren't guilty of the crime. You just heard about it in a neighboring city. And now you are responsible to do the investigation, prove that it's so. And after you were the first to put your wife to death, if she had done this, you're not to pity, you're not to spare, you're not to conceal. We're going to kill everybody in this city, gather all their stuff into the square, then burn the town and the stuff down, and then we're going to burn the titles to all that land too. Nobody gets to move in here and rebuild. I don't care if it's got the best view in the country. Prime land going down. Permanent display. You don't do like the nations around you do. You just don't. Because they're seducing you to act like them. And God won't have it. So he puts you both to the test. And if you're going to pass this test as a Jew, you may have to burn a whole city down after you've slaughtered its inhabitants. So he says in 17, nothing from that which is put under the ban shall cling to your hand, in order that Yahweh may turn from his burning anger and show mercy to you, have compassion on you, and make you increase, just as he has sworn to your fathers. If you'll listen to the voice of Yahweh your God, keeping his commandments, which I'm commanding you today, like the one he just uttered, and doing what is right in the sight of Yahweh your God. Now, brethren, that's a whole chapter that is devoted to the consequence of false doctrine. Okay? Please just make a note now underneath the Jeremiah 14, 13 through 16 that you wrote next to the first verse. Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 18 through 22. Deuteronomy 18, 18 through 22. Now you turn if you like, but by the time you get there, I'll finish reading it. I will raise up a prophet from among your countrymen like you, and I'll put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. It'll come about that whoever will not listen to my words which he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. But the prophet who shall speak a word presumptuously in my name which I have not commanded him to speak, or which he shall speak in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die. You may say in your heart, how shall we know the word which Yahweh has not spoken? When a prophet speaks in the name of Yahweh, like Ellen White, Joseph Smith, so many others, if the thing does not come about or come true, that is the thing which Yahweh has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You shall not be afraid of him. And that means you shall not respect him. But how afraid are you of dead people anyway? Because you just killed him. So whether the miracle comes to pass and he counsels something you can't read in Scripture, or he claims that he can foretell the future and it doesn't happen, which both in spades Ellen and Joseph did, then what? Put him to death. Okay? Have no respect. Don't pity. No compassion. Don't conceal. Down to your wife and children. It matters, brethren. And we can't just say, well, we're Christians now, so what you taught back there doesn't apply to us. What he taught back there, we are told both in Romans and 1 Corinthians, was for our instruction. by the way, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. For those of you who have been in my other class, Matthew here lately. Okay, so how can it be more dramatic? It's central and at length and more than a lot of other things. Purity of doctrine is everything, and particularly in our land, Satan has been most effective in teaching that doctrine doesn't matter. We're all going to heaven on different roads. We should all just get along. You know, nobody ever speak evil of anybody. You know, you can't tell them they're wrong. It's just all of that, brethren, is the antithesis of God's mind on the subject of his doctrine for every covenant he's ever made. Now, chapter 14. Here we go. You are the sons of Yahweh your God. You shall not cut yourselves nor shave your forehead for the sake of the dead, a cultic practice among these seven nations that you're supposed to annihilate. You are a holy people to Yahweh your God, and Yahweh has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. You shall not eat any detestable thing, and I shall not read anything from here to verse 45. Okay, because we did all of that back in Leviticus, or not 45, I'm sorry, I was reading my own note, here to verse 21, and so make a note, this is nearly identical to Leviticus 11, verses 2 through 45, that's where I got my 45, Leviticus 11, 2 through 45 is just this list in 14, 3 through 21, so I'm not going to read any of that, we've been through all that before. We know that the dietary laws and the unclean and clean is not a moral law. That's why those restrictions didn't exist before they became Jews, and then were done away in Christ in his kingdom. So we got this big difference, Old Testament or New, between moral laws, which never change, and ceremonial laws, which do. Which is the reason why, back to Bill a little while ago, the unclean people could eat the unclean food. Because it's not a sin to eat any of those animals unless for 1,500 years you're a Jew and God's testing you to see if you'll obey my will. But the food itself is not inherently evil or immoral. I talked about this at length in Leviticus. So that's why it can be off the books and then on the books, or off the menu and then on the menu, you know, so easily here. But we talked about all of that. Now, I do want to just focus on one thing, though, and I'm going to give you another list. At the tail end of verse 21, should have been a separate verse, but it's just, you know, added on there. You shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. Now, we talked about that at length in Leviticus. I don't want to get into it again tonight. But, you know, for those of you that weren't here, Headley's, for instance, you know, and so many others, here's the list. You can't boil a kid in its mother's milk is in Exodus chapter 23, verse 19, and also in Exodus at 34:26. Now, I mentioned then, just this, it was another cultic practice. So it was apparently something they did in the worship of their idols. And or might have just been a simple, you know, kind of a don't be cruel, don't be that hard-hearted kind of a thing. But it looks to me more like the prohibition is there because you're being seduced to go do the things that they do in their cultic practices. So it's not just some crazy, stupid thing that Bill Maher can tell you, you know, is a good reason to burn your Bible. It is very reasonable in the culture and times to keep these people from being seduced. Now, let's read quickly 22 through 29, and we'll see if we can knock off, time looks good, chapter 15 as well. Because again, we're going to see some duplication now. So, 22. You shall surely tithe all the produce from what you sow, which comes out of the field every year. You shall eat in the presence of Yahweh your God at the place where he chooses, third time in joining chapters, to establish his name. The tithe of your grain, your new wine, your oils, firstborn of your herd, your flock, in order that you may learn to fear Yahweh your God always. Do you see that the tithing was for a purpose? What's the purpose? That you learn to fear. You learn to respect. You learn to respond, to obey, to be in submission. You learn to do it God's way and not yours. 24. And if the distance is so great for you that you're not able to bring the tithe. Now, the elderly would, you know, come. Everybody comes to a stage where they just can't do it. God understands. since the place where Yahweh your God chooses to set his name is too far away from you, when Yahweh your God blesses you, 25, then you shall exchange it for money, bind the money in your hand, go to the place which Yahweh your God chooses, and you may spend the money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen, sheep, wine, strong drink, whatever your heart desires. There you shall eat in the presence of Yahweh your God and rejoice, you and your household. So you might not be fit anymore to drive, you know, your animal 100 miles to Jerusalem, so we'll let you buy it if that's the case. Now, highlight just two words in verse 26, and let me dispel a myth that I was taught for probably 20 years when I first became a Christian. Those two words are strong drink. I believed the error passionately, taught it frequently, that in the Old Testament you could drink a lower alcoholic content beverage like wine, but I was taught and frequently, you know, passed it along that strong drink is always condemned. Well, it isn't in this verse at all. So I was really quite stunned after teachers that I still respect, you know, had apparently been doing the same thing, passing on this myth, and we all just took it for fact because everybody said it. It's not true. This verse does not forbid strong drink. What does the Bible, Old Testament, and New universally condemn and forbid? Getting drunk. Okay, so it wasn't just that easy. You know, this, I don't even know where it came from, this idea that strong drink's always condemned, but wine isn't. It's just not true. There it is, right there in that verse. Okay, so, 27. Also, you shall not neglect the Levite who's in your town, for he has no portion or inheritance among you. At the end of every third year, you shall bring out all the tithe of your produce in that year and deposit it in your town. And the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance among you, and the alien, the orphan, and the widow who are in your town, shall come and eat and be satisfied, in order that Yahweh your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. Now, it's important to me we take these next 10 minutes and we get through these next 23 verses, because we're going to have a companion verse to that last verse. So next to verse 29, you might want to write ahead of this, see chapter 15, which is the next chapter, verse 11. That says, the poor will never cease to be in your land. Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall freely open your hand to your brother, to your needy and poor in your land. But we're going to have a whole lot about the poor here in chapter 15 now, so let's just read it. At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a remission. This is the manner of remission. Every creditor shall release what he has loaned to his neighbor. He shall not exact it of his neighbor and his brother, because the Lord's remission has been proclaimed. From a foreigner you may exact it, but your hand shall release whatever of yours is with your brother. Now let's just stop right there. What this means is, some fellow Jew comes to you and says, I'm in dire straits, I need some money, please can I have $10,000? He's come to you because he knows you've got it. So what do? You give it to him. And it's the day after the seventh year thing, you know, of remission. So you got a full what until the next one? 7 years. What's he supposed to be doing? Paying you back. But what if there's only 6 months to go? Changes everything. Wow, I saw you all flinch. Whoa, $10,000 6 months, and then whatever he pays back's mine. I'm going to lose $9,500. Well, maybe. Verse 4. However, there shall be no poor among you, since Yahweh will surely bless you in the land which Yahweh your God is giving you as an inheritance to possess. If only you listen obediently to the voice of the Lord your God, and by the way, I think he means all the commands up to and including the capital punishment offenses. If you listen obediently to the voice of Yahweh your God, you observe carefully all this commandment which I am commanding you today. For Yahweh your God shall bless you as he's promised you. You'll lend to many nations. You'll not borrow. You'll rule over many nations, but they'll not rule over you. If there's a poor man with you, one of your brothers, in any of your towns in your land, which Yahweh your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor close your hand from your poor brother. But you shall freely open your hand to him, shall generously lend him sufficient for his need in whatever he lacks. Beware lest there is a base thought in your head, saying, the seventh year, the year of remission is near, and your eyes hostile toward your poor brother. You give him nothing. Then he may cry to Yahweh against you, and it will be a sin in you. You shall generously give to him. Your heart shall not be grieved when you give to him. Because for this thing, Yahweh your God will bless you in all your work and in all your undertakings. For the poor will never cease in the land. The poor you have with you always. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall freely open your hand to your brother, to your needy and poor in your land. If your kinsman, a Hebrew man or woman, is sold to you, then he shall serve you 6 years, but in the seventh year you shall set him free. Say, for instance, he accused the woman and she wasn't guilty, like we studied, of any sexual impropriety, and now you've defamed a virgin in Israel. What do you have to do? You've got to pay 8 years and 4 months' wages, 8 years and 4 months, and you can never divorce her. So that means even if she later goes and commits adultery, you can't put her away. Wow. God's pretty serious about these things. So when you hear these laws, you better keep them. This kinsman, woman, sold to you, served 6 years, 7 years, set them free. When you set them free, you not set them away empty-handed. Furnish liberally from your flock, from your threshing floor, from your wine vat. Give to him as the Lord your God has blessed you. And you shall remember you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and Yahweh your God redeemed you. Therefore I command you this day. And it shall come about if he says to you, I will not go out from you, because he loves you and your household, since he fares well with you. Then you shall take an awl and pierce it through his ear into the door. He shall be your servant forever. And also you shall do likewise to your maidservant. It shall not seem hard to you when you set him free. For he has given you 6 years, double the service of a hired man. Now I think what that means, brethren, is that this person now is, you know, a slave for 6 years. But they're living with you then, and not like a hired man. And I'm pretty sure it's just like it is today. They had working hours for a hired man. But this guy's living with you. You're getting twice as much work out of him in a day. You got a slave. So if you want to make him work 16 hours, you can do it. And he'll love you so much for it, he'll allow himself to have his ear impaled to a door jamb so he can continue when the year of Jubilee comes. Properly executed, slavery's great. And God loves it. Because it's not immoral. God never permits what is immoral. If it's inherently sinful, he's not going to tell you it's okay. But these people behave properly, so properly, that when the time was up, the guy doesn't want to leave anymore. And it sounds like, you know, the master doesn't have any choice either. It sounds like he has to keep him. So imagine what it was like in Israel, brethren, if you just weren't seduced to act like the people around you. God says, I'm going to bless you so mightily that whenever anybody comes from your brethren and wants to borrow money, you'll have it. Just give it to them. Even if it's only the day after tomorrow to the end of that seventh year, and they want a lot, just give it to them, and you'll have it to give. And I, God, I'm testing you. And when you do this, I'll bless you even more. And you guys, you're going to become the bankers of the world. You're going to loan to every nation, and no nation can conquer you. If you'll just have what? What we often think doesn't exist in the Old Testament at all. Brethren, with everything he's just said, what is he asking them to have? Faith. Will you just trust your God that it'll be okay? But it doesn't make any business sense. I know, doesn't matter. I'm not talking about a business that's without God. I'm talking about his people that he's made promises to. It would have been so wonderful. So in 18 again, it shall not seem hard to you when you set him free, for he's given you 6 years, double service of a hired man. So Yahweh your God will bless you in whatever you do. Don't begrudge it. You're going to get more if you just let him go. 19. You shall consecrate to Yahweh your God all the firstborn males that are born of your herd and of your flock. You shall not work with the firstborn of your herd, nor shear the firstborn of your flock. You and your household shall eat it every year before Yahweh your God in the place which Yahweh chooses. So the firstborn in these tithes and dedications, you know, then will be sacrificed. And at that point, once it's sacrificed, then you can eat it. 21. But if it has any defect, that firstborn, lameness or blindness or any serious defect, you shall not sacrifice it to Yahweh your God. You shall eat it within your gates, the unclean and the clean alike, as a gazelle or a deer. Only you shall not eat its blood. You are to pour it out on the ground like water. So, brethren, four adjoining chapters, three times he says that exact same thing. Now, I've read all these verses, but what would it be? 19 of them, you know, tonight. And we did it in an hour, plus a lot of commentary. So in these four chapters, how much repetition was there? Just a lot. Why? I'll tell you why. It's because Ron is thick-headed. Now, it's all just for him. Everybody else gets it. They hear it one time and they got it. And they never have to hear you. But that Ron, that guy needs to hear it more than you do. Okay. Amen. Class dismissed.